Support for Radio Boston comes from Hadestown at the Box Center Wang Theater, Broadway's Tony and Grammy-winning Best Musical, an epic celebration of music, togetherness, and hope, raves Forbes. Playing April 23rd through April 28th. Buy your tickets today at boxcenter.org.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Happy Election Day, everyone. There are key elections going on in many communities, the mayoral race in Boston, for example, or Framingham voters creating a city government today, electing a mayor and city council for the first time, just to name a few. Plus, it was almost a year ago that President Donald Trump won the White House with a majority of the Electoral College and a minority of the popular vote. So we wanted to take a moment to examine that a little more closely, because Washington Post columnist E.J. Dionne's new book starts with this pointed sentence. He says, quote, "American democracy was never supposed to give the nation a president like Donald Trump. And yet it did. How? Why? And for those who believe that the forces that gave rise to a Trump presidency are also eroding American democracy, the biggest question may be what to do about it." Well, Dionne's new book, co-authored with Norman Ornstein and Thomas Mann, is called One Nation After Trump, A Guide for the Perplexed, the Disillusioned, the Desperate, and the Not Yet Deported. And E.J. Dionne joins us in the studio now. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Great to be with you. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. Also with us today is Heather Cox Richardson. She's a professor of history at Boston College and author of To Make Men Free, A History of the Republican Party. Plus, she's co-host of the WBUR podcast Freak Out and Carry On. Professor Richardson, it is good to see you again.
It's always a pleasure, Meghna.
And thank you for...
And can I say it's great to be with Professor Richardson, whom I've admired for a long time.
She's gonna lend some intellectual heft where I fall short here. But EJ, I wanted to start with a very simple question, just get right to a certain point that may speak really to how broken our politics is right now. And that is, you know, for a lot of listeners who hear the title of your book and then hear that I'm talking to EJ Dionne, Washington Post columnist, what reason is there to believe, for them to believe, that this is anything other than a Democrat's lament to still disillusion Democrats? I mean, it just sounds like this is sort of an introspective kind of book and conversation, given the title, One Nation After Trump. Or do you have a bigger message here?
Well, I think the title actually reflects a belief on the part of all three of us that there can be one nation after Trump, that this is not the end of the story, that there are reasons this happened, and that there are ways in which we can overcome what we believe was a genuine catastrophe that befell the nation.
Can I just jump in here for a second, EJ? Because I want to say you said all three of us, but I actually believe there is one nation now. So, and that
when I said all three of us, I'm sorry, I was talking about the authors of the book.
Okay, Thomas. Okay,
yeah, no, I believe there is one nation now, but I believe that we can create a sense of that one nation after a period of extraordinary division and fracturing. And indeed, as we say in the book, we quite consciously had the words of the Pledge of Allegiance in our heads. People forget, by the way, the pledge was written by a socialist. The pledge is actually a very progressive, forward-looking statement, and it ends with one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. Under God was added, by the way, in the 1950s. And we don't pretend to speak for the Almighty, but with liberty and justice for all is what America is supposed to be about. And that cause suffered a real setback in this last election. So, but we think of it as a hopeful book for a couple of reasons. One is we go on at some length about the reaction to this election. Mm-hmm. There really is an extraordinary amount of organizing going on. There were spontaneous and then increasingly well-organized responses from civil society to everything from Trump's travel ban to the proposal to repeal Obamacare. We forget how extraordinary it was that everybody going into the year said Republican president, Republican Congress, Obamacare is dead. It isn't dead. Trump is trying to kill it in other ways. But it isn't dead because people showed up at these congressional offices. The country reflected on what repeal would mean. And a lot of people changed their mind on Obamacare. Yeah. So the book is very critical of Trump. We point out the ways in which we see him as having a lot of autocratic tendencies that are quite dangerous to democracy itself. But it's also forward-looking and hopeful, And it's based on our belief we will overcome this.
Well, so I do want to spend some time sort of talking about the forward-looking portion of the book. But let's spend a minute or two here talking about your analysis about how and why America arrived at a Trump presidency. And actually, Heather, I want to pull you in here because, again, I'm just taken by the first sentence in EJ's book that American democracy was never supposed to give the nation a president like Donald Trump, because I still, at the risk of repeating myself, I still think there are 60 million voters out there who would disagree with that and say, actually, yes, American democracy, the way it's built, the way it's set up, is exactly what allowed a person like Donald Trump to become president. And they don't have a problem with that.
There might be people who say that, but I'm with EJ on this one. I think he's right on, and this book is right on, the idea that the system was never set up to put in place somebody who doesn't believe in the system. And that's what we've got now, is a president and an administration and members of a political party who actually are looking actively to dismantle the government. And that is something that has developed over the last generation, the idea that somehow our government is the problem rather than the solution. And that's not to say it shouldn't be trimmed or we shouldn't make it do different things, but rather that we have, until recently, always had in charge of the government people who wanted to make it succeed rather than wanted to destroy it.
Hmm. The other thing that I think always needs to be pointed out is we have developed into a non-majoritarian democracy, which is an oxymoron, really, and that the fact that Hillary Clinton got 2.9 million more votes than Trump matters. The fact that this is the second election in just since 2000 in which the Electoral College was out of sync with the popular vote tells us how antiquated these institutions are, that an Electoral College does not reflect the movement of people in the country to large metropolitan areas. It doesn't reflect the diversity of the country. Mm. So we think we're in for some problems ahead if we don't think about how to fix this system. Same is true of the Senate. It's gerrymandering contributes to this, and a campaign money system that gives excessive power to a very small number of people.
You talk about how you take an extreme example in the book and how currently a voter in Wyoming has 3.5 times the electoral power as a California voter because of the way the system's set up.
Right. And that if you, thank you for that. And if you look at the founding, the ratio between the smallest and largest state was 13-1. Now it's about 70-1 and rising. That creates a problem also for the United States Senate in the long run. And the Constitution makes it very hard to change representation in the Senate. But by 2040, 70% of Americans will live in 15 states. That means 70% of us will be represented by 30 senators. So I think that's a piece of the puzzle here. But the other piece we can't deny is the country has gone through a very difficult period in the last 15 years and in the last 30 years, that income inequality has been rising since, depending on where you want to date it, the mid-70s or 1980. It really started going haywire in the after 2000. That's a big problem. We went through a long period of inconclusive wars where the country looked at its leadership and said, how did we get involved in these sorts of things? So there was a lot of fed-upness in the country, and Trump took advantage of that fed-upness.
Right.
And he said, I'm going to drain the swamp, although, in fact, he's doing more to pollute the swamp than to drain
it. You describe the Trump presidency in the book as sort of more of a symptom of deeper woes rather than the illness itself. But I don't want to leave the Electoral College here just for a second, because two questions about that. One is, you talked about antiquated systems. I mean, the antiquated system we're talking about is built into the Constitution of the United States,
correct,
right? And so, I mean, in that case, an alternative take would be that while you see it as a bias against the majority, the founders saw it as protecting against the tyranny of the majority. And, I mean, does that not still does that viewpoint still not have any relevance? Heather, maybe I'll throw this to you. In 2017 America.
So I am with EJN's spirit on this one, but there are some differences here in that it is in the Constitution, the Electoral College is in the Constitution, and what that means is that technically we don't elect our presidents, we elect electors, mm-hmm, who then elect our presidents. And each state has a number of votes in the Electoral College equal to their representation in the House and in the Senate. And that's a problem because we have limited the number of seats in the House of Representatives. What that means is that extraordinarily large states like California or New York don't actually have the accurate representation in the Electoral College they should. That's an issue, and that we should unpack a little bit. But what EJ started out by identifying seems to me to be the crucial issue right now, and that is that four times in our history we have had a president installed who lost the majority vote. It happened twice in the 19th century, and it's happened twice in the last in our lifetimes. And that suggests every time that happens, what you have is the threat of an illegitimate government, a government that the majority of people say, hey, it's not my government. It's not democracy. This is not what I voted for. And that is a crisis that should strike fear into the heart of every single American. We must find a way around that.
Right.
Just a quick point. The system we have now in no way resembles what the founders had in mind anyway, because the founders didn't conceive that we would elect electors with popular votes. So the Electoral College was supposed to be a deliberative body. It's not a deliberative body. So we have this hybrid system that we created willy-nilly over a period of 100 years. It's not what the founders particularly wanted, and it's not functional now.
Well, so what happens is after the 1804 election, that states realize when the Electoral College creates a complete mess and it gets thrown to the House of Representatives, states stop making a deliberative body and they throw all their votes. They group winner takes all votes in most of the states. The other thing that's changed with the Electoral College is the addition of so many new states, including the six we got from 1889 to 1890, Wyoming, Idaho, North Dakota, South Dakota, that were deliberately put there to game the electoral system. Mm. So yes, it's not the same as it's always been. Montana's also in that one. It's not the same as it's always been, but it would be very hard to go back and say, let's rip this sucker out altogether. And how to fix that is, it seems to me, very much on the table. There's a lot of people with a lot of different suggestions, and so far I'm not seeing one that jumps out that says, oh yeah, this is obvious.
So I'm sorry to take this back to politics specifically, but EJ, forgive me, because I have to ask, I can't help this. Would you be saying the same things if Hillary Clinton had won the election, but with a minority of the popular vote?
I'd like to think so. I mean, I think there is a problem with, I think there's writing by me all the way back to 2000 saying that there would be a problem if 2000 had gone the other way and if Bush had won the popular vote and Gore had won the Electoral College. So I think there is a principal problem there. Obviously, I'll confess, it's easier for me to say this because Donald Trump is the beneficiary. There's no question about that. But I think there's something fundamentally wrong with a country that claims to be a democratic republic that has an undemocratic outcome of this sort. And Heather's absolutely right about this legitimacy problem. And because we've had it twice in just a few elections, if we keep doing this, then all the claims we make about ourselves as a great model democracy just will not be borne out, which is why, I mean, I think the best scheme on the table, and it's imperfect, is this national popular vote movement where enough states commit themselves to direct their electors to the winner of the popular vote that you would de facto change the system. That's a long way from happening right now.
Right. But I was just going to ask you that, like sort of a reality check here.
Maybe there are about 160 electoral votes. I've forgotten the exact number. We have it in the book. There are states that have started doing this. The state that I vote in, Maryland, is part of that compact.
Right. But it's, I mean, Heather, your thoughts, because it just seems like it aspirational is the best way for me to put it in terms of making actual changes to the electoral process for the presidency.
It's not where I would start. I would start by getting voters to the polls, by insisting, you know, by stopping voter suppression and making sure that everybody has an ID, a national ID. And I actually think that this is something that everybody can get behind. And I know there are objections to it both on the left and the right, but that everybody has a national ID that must be taken at the polls. And another suggestion that was in EJ's book, that you have to have a guarantee that you can vote within a half an hour of the time you get to a poll. Because the suppression of the vote is very easy to do by things like not putting in enough voting machines or making voting machines that are broken or break easily. If we fixed that, the rest of it, it seems to me, would fall into place much more easily. The gerrymandering, the problems with the Electoral College, because you put the voters back in place, the Electoral College starts to go the right way.
And I think that adding to that list is universal voter registration, where it should be automatic that you get registered to vote. We have a controversial idea that we know is not going to happen down the road, but we talk about compulsory voting, or as we prefer to call it, compulsory attendance at the polls, because or universal voting. You can draw a Mickey Mouse on your ballot if you want. Australia has a system. It's worked very well for many years. The fine is very small. What I like about it is that it changes the obligations of local governments. They can't suppress the vote anymore. Their obligation is to make it as easy as possible for you to fulfill your civic obligation that you are now bound by law to live up to. And we took the secret ballot from Australia, so why not this one?
So we've spent quite a bit of time talking about the mechanics of voting, which is important, right? And it's going to continue to be an important issue. But EJ, in the book, you write quite deeply, you and your co-authors, about kind of more profound economic and social challenges in the United States that have led us to this moment, right? And basically, you call for sort of in fixing America's broken democracy, you call for a new economy, a new patriotism, a new civil society, and a new democracy. It sounds like rebuilding the country from the ground up, practically.
Well, given the wreckage right now, I think we do need quite a fundamental look at what's wrong, at what led us to a president who should not be there. So the new democracy part I won't talk about, because we talked about a number of pieces that we have in that new democracy section, a lot on voting and the right to vote and a new Voting Rights Act and fixes to the electoral system and ending gerrymandering, which Supreme Court might help us on soon, if Justice Kennedy decides to. So I'll leave that aside. For a new economy, we have a broad kind of egalitarian program that, and we point out that there are a lot of ideas that are already out there that need to be organized in a way that are compelling to people. We talk about Senator Warren has a whole series of ideas about how to give people rights in the gig economy. Senator Sherrod Brown introduced a great workers' bill of rights. Senator Gillibrand introduced a great kind of pro-family set and pro-women set of changes that would be particularly beneficial to women in the workforce, having to do with both pay and family leave, but also beneficial to everybody. But we need to recognize, I think, with the problem with, and I'm not one of those who's a Hillary basher, and I actually think she's a very impressive person. But the problem with that campaign, I think, is they didn't fully grasp how much they had to break through on economics. She had a lot of things in her economic program that were quite compelling. They didn't advertise on it. Trump advertised far more on the economy than Hillary Clinton did. And they can complain quite rightly that the press paid more attention to empty podiums at Trump rallies waiting, the television media, to empty podiums waiting for Trump to show up than a Hillary Clinton economic speech. But the job of a campaign is to get your message through. And I don't think they got that through. And then we can talk about a new patriotism and a new civil society later.
But the new economy part, I mean, I there are parts of the book when I was reading sort of your suggestions that made me wonder if you're sort of edging into Bernie Sanders territory here. Because let me just ask you flat out. I mean, is unfettered capitalism part of the problem here? And if so, don't Democrats, shouldn't they be looking in the mirror to in terms of the policies that they brought about in the 90s that helped us get to this point?
Well, we talked some about that, and I've talked about some of that in the past, some of the deregulation of Wall Street. Even Bill Clinton now thinks he made some mistakes in that sphere. But we talk about a broad center left, and that you can't win without Bernie Sanders and his people, and you can't win an election. You can't elect a progressive without more moderate voters. And unfettered is the key. A market system can work very well. An unfettered market system has never worked well. The reason we have regulation is, among other things, because we had a Great Depression and then we had this Great Recession. The reason we have a social safety net is that capitalism all by itself is not going to operate successfully. So that, you know, I've always said that the people who end up saving capitalism every time are capitalism's critics, because they're the people who know that this system all by itself isn't going to work.
I want to get Heather's thought on this.
Well, so I think when you look at the proposals that people like E.J. Dionne are putting out there, or you look at where we are in the country, or even if you look at the people who voted for Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders, and the idea that you suggested earlier, you know, the idea that he shouldn't be president, a lot of people voted for him because they wanted to wreck the system the way it was.
Exactly.
And the what we it seems to me fundamentally what we are looking at is a question of, for whom should our government work? Should it work for the people at the bottom who are working hard and trying to make it and trying to feed their kids and trying to put to, you know, do things work from the bottom up or from the top down? And what we have right now and have had since 1980 is an ideology that says the system works best if it works from the top down, and you slash everything so that the people at the top who really know what they're doing better than anybody else can have their have free rein to do whatever they want. And this is a moment, Donald Trump's election seemed to me to be a moment, almost a snapshot, where people said, wait a minute. You've been telling us for a generation that this is going to work, and we've moved backward. 99% of us are in much worse shape, and we don't like it. So what are we going to do? And they threw that into chaos, and the government into chaos, and the country into chaos, in all sorts of ugly ways as well as productive ways. But this is the moment where people say, we need to take our government back. And when that happens, when America does that, change happens fast. So, yeah, EJ's book looks like a grab bag in a lot of ways. And that's one of the things I find very frustrating about this moment is everyone's got that one magic thing or the, you know, the string bag full of all these different things that you could put in it. But when these moments happen, when Americans say, no, that's not the government we want, change is often extraordinarily rapid. FDR's first 100 days, Abraham Lincoln's first 3 months. You know, when things change in America, they often change on a dime.
Yeah.
It's a happy grab bag. Can I plug Heather's last book, or I think it was your last book, on the Republican Party? Because this notion of unfettered capitalism and needing ideas to counter the market, as Heather points out in that book, Abraham Lincoln, besides using federal power to end slavery, that was a period that gave us the land-grant colleges, which have done enormous amounts of good over a very long period of time. It's a period that gave us the Homestead Act, which created a whole new set of landowners, small landowners in the country. Teddy Roosevelt, by the way, was for campaign finance reform, among other things.
And health care.
And health care. And then Dwight Eisenhower, interstate highways and the federal student loan program started under Dwight Eisenhower. There was once a Republican Party that was willing to acknowledge that using government to improve the lives of people and to invest in the country's future was a useful thing to do.
Yeah, no,
and we
need to
reclaim that.
I actually think that perhaps I would say that both parties need to reclaim that, because yes, Hillary Clinton won the majority of the popular vote. I get it, but I think for all those people who were once Obama voters but then voted for Trump, they were saying, we don't see a Democratic Party necessarily that recognizes our needs so much anymore. I just got a couple of minutes left, and I wanted to ask both of you one thing, because, yeah, there are lots of ideas in your book, EJ, and I think taken individually, they all seem to make a lot of sense. But there's one line that you have actually comes early in the book where you say that to see Trumpism, to see where Trumpism comes from is to understand that this worldview, as we've been discussing, didn't just suddenly sweep the nation. It's been 40 years in the making. But then you go on, you say, and it does not represent an irresistible wave of the future. Now, I wonder why you're so confident about that, because the very same forces that got us here, to me, the remedies that you suggest in the book require those forces to consciously let go of the power they've accumulated in the past couple of generations. And that seems to be an enormous challenge right now.
Trumpism is not the wave of the future demographically, first of all. If you look at the country that will exist in 10 or 20 years, it's going to be a different country. Young people are progressive. Trump gained nothing among young people. Hillary lost some votes to third party voting. The country will be more diverse, Latino, more African-American, more Asian. Trumpism does not represent that wave at all. So that's one reason why it doesn't represent the way of the future. The other is Trumpism doesn't represent the interests of the very working class that he claimed to talk about. And this new tax bill is exhibit number one. It's the oligarchy tax cut of 2017. And I think that Trump's working class supporters are not indifferent to their own circumstance. And they're not going to look at this and say, gee, that's really good for us. They know it's not.
Yeah. Heather, last quick thought.
I think you either believe in human self-determination in America and in American democracy, or you don't. And I happen to believe in it.
Well,
amen.
E.J. Dionne's new book is One Nation After Trump, A Guide for the Perplexed, the Disillusioned, the Desperate, and the Not Yet Deported. And Heather Cox Richardson, who is also with us today, she's a history professor at Boston College. And by the way, Heather will be moderating a panel discussion with E.J. and one of his co-authors, Norman Ornstein, at the Edward Kennedy Institute for the U.S. Senate tomorrow night. We've got information about that at radioboston.org. Thank you so much, both of you, for coming in.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.